CrimeCon is a draw here in the city of Indianapolis for people both local and outside of Indiana. One of the other big draws to CrimeCon, podcasts. Actually, participants are able to watch videos about crimes that made national headlines. CrimeCon runs throughout the weekend here in Indianapolis, and it's open to everyone.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is your host, Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler. And with me today at CrimeCon is...
Laura Richards, co-creator and producer of The Case of JonBenet Ramsey and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service and advocate and author and analyst.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti, and I'm the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime, say it with me, and the minds that solve those crimes.
And
very special invited guest, Jim Fitzgerald, who's been a more or less regular person on the show. So thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we have another very special guest or guests, CrimeCon. Let's
yes!
hear it. Wow, thank you, thank you. It's so great that everybody is here. We're so happy to be able to be doing this podcast with a live audience from CrimeCon 17. We're so thankful that everybody came here, and we're so grateful for all the support that we've gotten, because you know what it means? It means that you guys love the fact that we are a victim-centric podcast.
Absolutely.
We talk about crime, but we do it from the victim's perspective. We give them back their voice. Thank you so much. So this applause is for you.
Yes. So if you've been listening recently, you know that we've been covering the case that's commonly called the West Memphis Three. And to us, of course, that those three are Chris Byers, Stevie Branch, and Michael Moore, who were 3 8-year-old boys who were tragically and senselessly murdered in 1993. But today, we're going to hit pause on talking about that case, but we are going to talk about a topic that came up while Jim and Laura were profiling the case last episode, and that is the subject of children who are abducted and killed, because they know a lot about this, and I think you've asked me what are the most heartbreaking cases they've ever worked on, and I would guess that those cases are the most heartbreaking. So with that, I'm going to throw it over to Jim and Laura.
Well, I will agree that those are the most heartbreaking cases that I've worked in my career. The hardest thing in the world is to have to inform parents or family members that their child has been abducted and killed, and it's not something anybody would want to do. But it's also really important to be supportive and compassionate to them, so that's where the humanity comes in. And despite the fact that many parents' lives were devastated by the deaths of their children, I was amazed at how many strong, amazing, dedicated people then became advocates for other children that they didn't know, protecting them. Things like the Amber Alert, for example, is an amazing tool to help save kids. And if it weren't for Amber's parents, it would never have become law. So I have to sort of tip my hat and give thanks to the people who suffered tremendously, but were able to still find a way to kind of move forward and do something positive with the rest of their lives to save other kids. How about you, Laura?
Well, I think a question that I get asked a lot, and some of you have may have seen that recently I gave an interview on CNN talking about the case of Madeleine McCann. Do you remember this case? So 10 years ago, it was the anniversary, it was in Portugal, and you know, I was asked the question right at the end of the interview, do I still think she's alive? And people do ask, you know, what are the statistics on children being recovered and found alive? So I just wanted to sort of let you know that what the stats tell us and why it's so important to have the Amber Alerts, because there are critical windows of time, and you're probably familiar with that. You probably get Amber Alerts on your iPhones too. But 44% of the children that go missing are believed to be abducted, are murdered and killed within the first hour. So that window of time is vital. That's where law enforcement, you know, raising the alarm and making sure that the good practice that was developed at the FBI is promulgated. And then you have 73% of children are killed within the first 3 hours, and then 99% of children within the first 24. So you can really see when we think about the West Memphis 3 case, the three little boys, the alarm wasn't really raised till the next day in terms of searching. With Madeleine McCann, that's exactly what happened too. Actually, it wasn't until 10 o'clock the next morning that they put the roadblocks up looking for vehicles and asking questions, and Interpol did not put out the full alert until 5 days later. But what we do know is 1% of cases, we find them alive. And you might like to cast your mind back to, I was in Yosemite literally a couple of days ago training the rangers and police officers there, and I was thinking about cases. You know, whenever I go out and deliver training, I think about that locality and what happened. And you might think Yosemite is a place of natural beauty, which it is, right? And you don't want to think that crime happens there. But I cast my mind back to a case that actually started, well, I remember watching it as a mini-series, and it was called I Know My First Name is Stephen. Do you remember this case? Stephen Stainer, abducted at the age of 7 by someone called Kenneth Parnell. And he raised the alarm. He managed to escape because he had abducted another little boy called Timmy. And he had basically managed to get to a place of safety. Kenneth Parnell worked at Yosemite National Park as a bookkeeper. The short story was that then Stephen, trying to adapt 7 years later into his family life, you know, I always ask questions about what happens to those children there on after. And sadly, he died tragically in a motorcycle accident some 9 years later. But the case was back in the news. You might remember this, Jim. Mm-hmm. And I remember there was something that happened with his brother. Do you remember Carey Stainer, who was acting out sexually at the age of 11 and peeping on girls and women? And he ended up at Yosemite again, working at Cedars Lodge, and he abducted and killed 3 women and then went on to stalk another female called Joey Armstrong. And most of the rangers and law enforcement I was talking to there hadn't heard of that case. It was some time ago. But his behaviour, what I'm trying to do is also just connect some of the dots for you around stalking and predatory behaviour, and that much of it, we know stalking is a gateway offence. He was peeping on lots of people, women in particular, in his family, and also other women that he didn't know about. But that was a 1% of cases, Stephen being found, that, you know, very rare thing that happens. And you'll probably remember Elizabeth Smart in Utah. Can you remember other cases, Jim, with the 1% of cases where...
Well, the Ben Ownby, Sean Hornbeck case in St. Louis, where... J.C. Dugard as well. These are cases where people had basically lost hope. They just didn't think that they were ever going to get their child back, and yet they were alive. Obviously, there's a Cincinnati case where 3 girls were abducted and held and tortured, but because one of the girls was brave enough to fight her way out of there, she was able to rescue not only the 2 other girls, but also the daughter of one of those girls. So 4 girls were rescued that day. And again, they were basically thought of as dead and gone, but they weren't. They were alive, and today they're thriving again.
And of that 1%, how many of those are escaped or are found by law enforcement? Like, what's the...
Well, what it is that statistics of the children who were abducted and killed, 44% are killed in the first hour, 73% in the first 3 hours, and 99% in the first 24 hours. So the 1% talks about the ones that are killed after one day. But of all child abductions, long-term, non-familial child abductions, the statistic is that 67% of those in the study that we did were fatal events. In other words, the kid was killed. So that means 33%, a third, actually survived. And that could be as long as a few hours they were found afterwards, and it could also be months, years, and in fact, decades.
Fitz, you want in?
I just want to add a little different perspective to this, and Jim, you're familiar with the case I'm about to discuss very quickly. We had a woman come to the FBI in the early 90s thinking that her father was a serial killer, and she had memories from her childhood, among other things, of a little blonde-haired boy in her basement that her father put into a hole. This is actually in my third book, which is coming out next month. But his name was, and we did some research, and here at this time frame she was referring to, there was a young boy named Douglas Legg in the Syracuse, New York area who went missing from his family's sort of mountain home. So this happened in the early 70s. In the early 90s, along with a state trooper, I went and interviewed these parents, and we went to them, and we were very cautious to not give them any promises, to not let them think we may find their child. And this was the first time in my life, I had certainly talked to parents before of missing children, murdered children, raped children, but this is the first time, almost a longitudinal study, you could call it, 20 years later, we sat down with these parents. We called them in advance, they knew we were coming, and it was the most difficult interview I ever did. I can say that to this day in my professional career, because their son disappeared, they had no idea what happened to him. There's strong possibility he was kidnapped, he may have been lost in the woods, never found his remains. As difficult as it may be to have lost a child, any of you folks in here, parents, or certainly have loved ones, can you imagine never even knowing where that child wound up? And of course, we would have to almost tell them that there may be this guy from the Syracuse area that may have abused their child, put him in a hole, et cetera, et cetera. So we kept some of those graphic parts away. But they were so desperate after a while that they were hiring psychics and the people were charging them top dollar to find out where their son may be, but it never came about. So that chapter is in my upcoming book, and you will read a little bit more about that.
Well, what the BAU did when I was in the unit was we decided that we would study, because we're part of the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime, we would study all child abductions reported in the United States for a 10-year period so that we could then use that information to develop the child abduction response plan and the child abduction rapid deployment teams, which is what we did. And what we found were that in the United States of America, non-familial child abductions occurred approximately 150 to 200 times a year. Now, if you balance that against the reported child sexual victimization cases during every year, that number is about 350,000 to a million a year. So you can see how rare this type of occurrence is. Devastating occurrence, but extremely rare. So what we did was then we went to look at the relationships between the offenders and the victims. And what we found was there was a direct correlation between the age of the victim and the relationship between the victim and the offender. And the beginning of that correlation is that the younger the child is, the more closely in to that family the abductor or the false alleger of abduction is. So they're typically, and it makes sense because children that young are held within a ring of care and custody. And so the people who have access to that child are very limited. So typically we have to look closely to that child and their family and then work our way out in concentric circles from that family. It all makes very much sense. What we found is in a study in 1998, there were 652 children killed in the United States that year, 50 under the age of five. 56% were killed by their parents, 4% by other relatives. That's 60% by family, number 27% by friends and acquaintances. So you can see why we really want to focus in on that small circle around the family, especially when they're very young. And you can look at cases like JonBenet Ramsey, for example, and statistically, we know where that case would fall. We also, Laura and I, did the case of, and we did an investigation, and forensically and behaviorally, it also fell within a close ring around that family. So those are important statistics that we learned from our research. We also looked at the fact that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children reports over 800,000 missing kids a year. 800,000, when what we found is 150 to 200. Well, why is that? Because they're looking for funding and they use every single missing kid report, and what you get is kids who stayed a little late at their friend's house, kids who got lost, kids who were lying and going to the mall when they're not supposed to be there. But these things, the vast majority, 799,000 of those turn out to be not child abductions. So you have to understand that there are some people that, you know, kind of inflate those numbers, but the facts are, in the United States of America, around 160 kids, every year are abducted by a non-family member. And so basically, of those numbers, about 67% are fatalities.
So just to give a UK context to that, I work across both the US and the UK, but some of you may have watched a lot of UK true crime too, and you might want to think about contextualizing that of what Jim has said in the cases of Tia Sharp, who you may recall was apparently and allegedly abducted from her home address. This was in 2012. She was 12 years old, although no one had seen her. But her stepfather was very keen to make media and public appearances talking about Tia. And I was asked to listen to some of those interviews that he put himself forward for. And again, he was talking on the interview about her in the past tense, that she had walked off to go and buy some shoes, but nobody could place her. And actually, as the case unfolded, it turned out that she had been wrapped up in carpet and she'd been killed and placed in the loft. Only the first crime scene search hadn't gone up into the loft space. But he was a very interesting individual. His name was Stuart Hazel, who put himself up for interview. He was the stepfather. And interestingly, he had had a relationship with the mother and the grandmother, I believe, to target Tia, who was in the house. And a number of sexual abuse images were found that he was abusing her prior to killing her. And then some of the other cases that we've had that have been high profile, baby Peter Connolly, who was a seven-month-old baby, who I can see some of you nodding. Again, you know, he was abused consistently and repeatedly. He actually had 50 injuries on him. But it was his stepfather who had, it wasn't a fatal blow, but had punched him so hard in his face that he'd swallowed his teeth, his baby teeth. You know, when you review these cases or when you're involved in them, you know, the reality of how they're sort of shown on Hollywood or crime, you know, CSI, to the reality, is, I know you really appreciate that, is quite different. But it turned out to be, again, the stepfather, Stephen Barker, who had again engaged in a relationship with the mother, I believe, to access the child. So you can probably start to see a link with domestic abuse, domestic violence again here. And you do tend to see child abuse and domestic abuse co-occurring in the same household. And you might want to cast your mind back. It's just been dramatized, actually, to the Shannon Matthews case. Do you remember seeing this? I mean, it was actually a very good docu-series, but she went missing. She was 9 years of age on the 19th of February 2008. And as events unfolded, it turned out to be her mother and her stepfather who had... It was a false abduction. We're keeping her held in the uncle's home address, and they wanted the publicity to try and get money. It was a financial motive. So, you know, it was a terrible case in many senses. It was the largest sort of missing person inquiry that we had had, following on from a number of other cases, like Sarah Payne, you might recall, another young girl who went missing. And it ended up being a stranger-related case. But all the resources of law enforcement that went into trying to find Shannon, and all along it was her stepfather and her mother who had played a key role in orchestrating this false abduction.
What are the other motivations that parents have for killing their children? That's such a huge question. But in this case, it was for publicity. But what are...
Well, I mean, certainly the link with domestic abuse tends to be prevalent. When we think about, in the UK, we have serious case reviews. That's when a child dies, you know, and a very large percentage of those cases are domestic violence related. And if you understand sort of the literature, I won't go into too much of the academic side, but somehow the links between domestic violence and child abuse, you know, haven't always been made. And certainly when people do case presentations, And that's, for me, a really key part that why I brought in Domestic Violence Homicide Review, spearheading that campaign in 2004, was to ensure that if a mother died in a similar situation to the child being murdered, that we review those cases and we understand what the risks look like. Because it's a risk to the children and to the primary adult, normally the female, in those households. And particularly when you add in a blended family, a stepfather, right. Then, you know, again, you start to narrow your focus down with step-parents. If it's a male step-parent and a female step-child, you tend to see sexual abuse. And if it's a male step-child and a male stepfather, you tend to see quite serious physical and psychological abuse.
Right. And so the main motives for false allegations of child abduction turned out to be greed, because a non-biological father figure who's in the family does not want to be supporting this child who is not his own. Access, because the child takes up so much of the mother's time that that person feels, well, I'm just going to get the kid out of the equation in order to get more direct access to the mother, and frustration and anger and rage. And so sometimes it's because there's long-term domestic abuse. Sometimes it's because of alcohol or drug use. Sometimes it's just because of increased stressors in that person's life. They act out against the child. Children who are, you know, before they reach the age of 8, their skulls are extremely fragile. It's basically like two layers of an egg. And unfortunately, they're very easily injured and sometimes fatally just by being shoved or backhanded or pushed against something, and then they fall and hit their head on a corner of a table or something like that. And unfortunately, a child can expire very easily that way. And also, unfortunately, children are very disposable. It's very easy to hide the body, and that's why I believe we have so many of these cases that are completely unsolved after years and decades, because unfortunately, people will throw kids away, their bodies away, in plastic bags in a dumpster, and they get sent to a dump somewhere, and then they're never recovered. So it's a really sad thing, but those are the motives.
Just to add to what Jim just said, and there's two other motives for a male abductor or abuser, which is sexual, which is what the Tia Sharp case was, and power and control, that dynamic which you talked right. about, but I'm going to add the power and control element. And then for females, Jim and I have discussed, it tends to be much more emotion-based.
Yes. And so when we did the abduction study, we came up with basically four primary motives for child abductions or false allegations of child abductions. And 50% of the cases were sexually based, sexual motives. 31% were emotion based, like Laura just mentioned, and the other motions that I just spoke about. And 11% were for profit. And not traditional kidnapping cases, but typically they were gang-related or drug-related, where somebody didn't pay off a debt or somebody cheated somebody else, so they took a kid to get money back, that kind of thing. But then 8% were this thing we call maternal desire. And in those cases, a woman who wanted to have a child but either couldn't have a child, recently lost a child, or lied and told her partner or her friends that she was pregnant, now had to produce a child. And so they went into hospitals and stole newborn babies. Now, as a result of our study, we instituted security procedures across the United States in hospitals and neonatal units, and we were able to basically wipe out this crime almost completely in the United States. I've heard of two cases, although it was 8% of the cases back when we did this study. I've only heard of two cases since we instituted these procedures. Both of them were, one was in Puerto Rico and one was in a very rural hospital that didn't have many security procedures. But unfortunately, it's given rise to an even more horrendous crime, which is cesarean abductions. And that is abducting a woman who's pregnant and then cutting the baby out of them.
Jeez.
Yeah, sorry. I should have given you a warning. This is very graphic. But the fact is that this is a crime that has happened a number of times, and it just shows you the degree to which this maternal desire can drive somebody. Not that it's justified in any way, shape, or form, but that is their goal, and they will stop at nothing. So one of the things that we suggested as a result of this study and the increased security procedures at hospitals is do not put up the balloons in front of your house saying newborn here, you know, it's a boy or anything like that, because these people who are desperate to get access to a child.
I gave birth in New York City, and my children were in a neonatal unit, and there are signs all over the hospital saying, do not leave your baby alone for a second. And it was a very high security place, and still, they were very much on guard about it.
So the other thing that we learned was in terms of victims, who gets abducted and when in their life. We found that newborns, because they're basically fungible in the hospital, were about equally male and female victims. But once you got into infant age and toddler age, we found that males were about 20% more likely to be abducted than females. That may be because males may be allowed a little longer leash than females are. And we probably keep our little girls closer to us than our little boys. Maybe little boys wander off more, I don't know. But when you get to school age, everything changes. And girls are now the victims by 60%, a 60% margin, and then all the way through to through high school, where girls are now 80% of the victims of abduction. So part of it is because of who at the kind of freedom they have as they grow up. So the relationship between the offenders and victims, we found in the beginning, infants are taken by complete strangers, whereas toddlers are taken mostly by family members. And when they're in school age, it's almost equally split between acquaintances and strangers, because that's who they're exposed to. So there is, in these acquaintance cases, there is some prior knowledge of the victim, and that's half of these cases. So they're not, stranger danger is only a small percentage, and it's usually later in life rather than the younger children who get abducted by strangers.
And again, just to contextualize that, and those who are following our West Memphis 3 case, is there anybody who's been listening to, okay. Great. I mean, we decided not to talk about it in detail just because you might be at different stages in listening to that case. But when we think back that was 1993, there was a very high profile case in the UK of a little boy called Jamie Bulger. Do you remember? And that some of the last footage that was seen of him was being walked hand in hand with two 10-year-old boys. And this was up in Merseyside. But that sets the context for the case that happens in West Memphis. And obviously, you know, in terms of the media, it was an international media profile. And those two 10-year-olds, and Jim and I talked a lot about the age of criminal responsibility in the case of JonBenet Ramsey. I mean, the age of criminal responsibility in the UK is the age of 10. And those two boys, Thompson and Venables, you may recall, actually were put on trial for his murder. But it wasn't just a murder. They tortured him. And they tortured him severely. I won't go into the detail of what he endured and what he suffered. But I think there was a read across the pond to what happened in that case and talking about sort of ritualistic and torture aspect. And then when these three boys, Stevie, Christopher and Michael Moore, you know, are found, their bodies in West Memphis.
Right.
I think, you know, they thought they were looking for the same thing. But of course, you had the satanic and kind of ritualistic element thrown in there, too.
Yeah, you had that in that case. And those kids, those offenders, were 10 years old. And kids at that age are much more experimentative. And in the West Memphis case, the suspects that they arrested were older than that, 16, 17, 18 years old. And there's a lot less of that experimentation in that age group. And that case, there was absolutely no physical evidence of any kind of occult or any kind of torture or any kind of sacrifice, although they thought there might have been because they misread the forensics at the time. So the last, just to sum up this, the research that we did, the last category was offender gender by victim age category. So what we found was offenders who abduct newborns are almost 100% female offenders. When you get into infant and toddler range, it's about 50-50, male and females. Some of them are abduction, some of them are false allegations of abduction to cover up a homicide. And then when you get into school age, the scales tip again. And almost all the offenders are male offenders and female victims. So by the time you get to the end of high school, almost 100% of the offenders are male, and a high percentage of the victims are female. So that gave us the impetus to put together the Child Abduction Response Plan and Child Abduction Rapid Deployment Teams, which we went around the country, trained up law enforcement around the country so that we could rapidly, because of those child abduction statistics, the ones that are fatal, we wanted to rapidly respond to every case so that we weren't, you know, at the time, people were saying, well, let's wait a few hours, find out if they wander back. Well, there's no time for that in these cases. So we educated law enforcement, we put these procedures in place. So now law enforcement agencies across the country are now trained in what it takes to find a child who's been abducted right away and not wait.
So of course, I mean, these cases are every parent's worst nightmare, aren't they? In terms of, you know, the very worst thing happening. And the research, I mean, there's still a paucity of research, but, you know, the FBI have done a lot of research, and actually on these cases, and the UK have too. So the younger the victim, the more likely it is to be someone that's known. That having been said, you always keep an open mind, and what you'll probably understand in some of the cases that we've covered, certainly when we think about Meredith Kircher, if we up the age and think about, you know, the cases that we've covered, some of the key aspects of investigation or good practice, an open mind was not what we were seeing in terms of when we've reviewed cases, that people had a theory about what went on and then try and make all the evidence fit that theory. So the good standards in practice of investigation, you know, we feel strongly about making sure that we put that out there. You know, the research continues, and we've always got to remember, for Fitz, Jim and I, there's always the 1% of cases, the things that you just have never seen before, and it doesn't fit any of the profile or any of the research or anything that you've seen. So you always have to keep that open mind. So my answer to CNN, well, you can watch the interview online. We would hope that Madeleine McCann is still alive, but you can probably understand if you think about percentages. You know, there are a number of cases where a child has been recovered, but it's, you know, I would like to be an optimist and think that, yes, she will be recovered one day, but there's every, you know, probability that it will be body recovery rather than her being found alive. So I know we, you know, just to switch gears a little bit and to bring Fitz in, we were going to do some questions and answers, because I know time-wise we're...
Could I just add to what we're talking about real quick here, though?
Please do, Fitz.
And it just so happens I was in northern Spain on some FBI business when Madeleine disappeared. And I always wish that perhaps the Portuguese police somehow could have reached out to me, or their Spanish people who knew, Spanish authorities who knew I was there, but obviously that never came to play. But the other thing, you mentioned the 1% before, the case is unusual. As a young detective, I'm not sure how often this happens, but I worked a case of a biological mother and father who were both sexually abusing their 4-year-old daughter. And that was a very difficult case for me. I had a son about the same age at this time. And you know what? You can't go in the interview room and pound your fist down and call them all the names that you're thinking in the back of your head. And I know Jim's done some of these, and Lars, if not directly, when the case is, you know, unfolding, but maybe later on. And but you almost have to hold the hand of these people separately, of course. And they wound up both talking about each other, and they both admitted to sexually abusing their daughter. And as far as I know, they never got her back. So that would probably fit maybe close to the 1% of the more unusual type cases where both parents, both biological, are involved in sexually abusing a child.
Now, is that case in your book, Fitz?
It's not? In my second book, yes.
It's in the second book. And people can find your book on?
Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all those places.
And what's the title?
A Journey to the Center of the Mind. Some of you have read it. We've talked about it.
And hopefully they'll be available tomorrow.
You can order them out at the stand. It's been a little bit of a mix-up.
There you go.
Should we turn to questions?
Yeah. So okay. why don't we have you ask questions?
Wait, well, we have...
Oh, I'm sorry. Rewind that.
Sorry. So we put out the call for questions on our Facebook page, and we have some, and actually I think you can respond to this too. So remember a few weeks ago there was another crime podcast that mentioned us and mentioned that no crime has ever been solved by profiling, I believe, was the what they said. So is this true? Has any crime ever been solved by profiling?
Yeah.
And how accurate is profiling?
Jim, you can start. I'll let you start.
Only the ones in which I was the profiler.
Oh, I don't know that.
Are we talking TV profilers or real-life profilers?
I have no fucking idea what they meant.
This podcast that is admittedly administered and hosted by writers about crime, not about by actual profilers, made a statement that there was absolutely no cases solved by profiling. And one of the podcasters specifically noted the DC sniper case. This profile was wrong in the DC sniper case. Well, she's absolutely wrong, because that is a case that was absolutely solved by Jim Fitzgerald and myself as profilers in that room. And what it was, when she's talking about the profile was wrong, it's that statistically, snipers are lone individuals. They have a God complex. They do not work well with others. So we're probably looking for a middle-aged man, maybe a white man, who's out there shooting people. But that's just a generic thing. That's not what the actual profilers came up with when we were in the room, because Jim Fitzgerald looked at the writings that they left at several of the crime scenes, and he said, if this person is an adult, he's barely an adult, but I think he's a teenager. I remember it vividly. And everybody else in the room said, what? This guy is shooting and killing, shooting and killing, shooting and killing, in and out, stick and run, totally calm, totally planning and execution perfection. Nobody sees him. He's a ghost. He can't be. He must be late 40s, early 50s, police or military trained. So you have that type of profile, and you have a dichotomy with Jim's forensic linguistic profile. And I said, well, then either we have a guy who is decompensating whenever he's writing, so it looks like he's a child when he's writing, but he's a perfect, organized adult when he's shooting, or for the first time in U.S. history, we have a sniper teen. A lot of people blew up, right? And went back and forth, and then they said, well, that can't happen because snipers have God complexes and can't work together well. And I said, they can if one is much older and controlling the younger one, to the point where probably the best way to control the younger one is to be sexually victimizing him. And again, everybody kind of flipped out, if you remember, and said, you're just saying that because you're an expert in child sex crimes. And I said, well, I'm just telling you, that's what it looks like to me. And 5 years after they were caught, Malvo gave an interview, and he said that Muhammad had picked him up in a men's shelter. He was 16, 15 years old, and he had been sexually victimizing him and teaching him how to be a sniper.
And he was a stranger, yeah.
And if I may add, from a forensic linguistic perspective, I was the first one to say we probably had African Americans as our snipers, or at least one of them, because there were some vestiges of African American vernacular English. It's a very legitimate studied dialect in the U.S., but there were some clues to that in the letters they left. So for the first time, we're saying we may have two, there may be an age separation, and we may also have some black guys doing this, which is a little bit different than all that we said in the original profile was statistically, it's older white males who do this God complex, all that.
Right.
But after the first or second letter came in, I said, we may have an African American here as at least one of ours. And it turns out that was the case.
So profiling did solve the case. Once we put out that profile, within 24 hours, they arrested the snipers.
24 and hours?
Yes, 24 hours. We put out that profile. We said
African-American.
We said an African-American 45 to 55-year-old and a teenage other person. We weren't sure which if they were both African-American, but we did have one sighting of an African-American kid with an afro that one of the sheriff's departments completely discounted. So we were thinking that it's probably two African-American males, one in his late teens, one in his 40s to 50s, who were driving a dark sedan, not a white van, and Jim nailed it completely because actually Malvo was from the islands and he said there was some island influence in the language, which also the Caribbean influence in the tarot cards as well, I remember you saying. And so that profile
Mr. Police. Was, Mr. Police, yes. They use the term, which is very
right.
unusual
as
for
if,
the U.S.
Yeah, I remember you saying, he said, it says, this is for you, Mr. Police, as if you're looking up to the police, right?
Deferential.
Yes, and instead of saying no media, right, it said no press, right? And that's press is kind of an outdated term for us here. but it's still used some other places. So anyway, the profile was spot on. It did solve the case, and it stopped people from killing. So to say that profiling does, I mean, the very first, and you're reading Incendiary, right, about the Mad Bomber of New York from the 1940s, which was the very first case on record of profiling solving a case. So to say that, that we never solved a case, I hope you're listening out there, because you gave us a really good laugh.
So that's the US. I mean, the same can be said in the UK. And, you know, with the case that Jim and Jim, Fitz and Jim C, have just described, I'd say that's a 1% of case, as in double-handed sniper, and it involves sexual coercion. So if we think about coercive controlling behavior, he was controlling through sexual coercion. But certainly in the UK, one of the first cases profiling was used was on Duffy and McCahey, who were... they were called the railway rapists, and they raped and murdered a number of women up in Hampstead Heath. And actually, they were caught via profiling. It's a case that's kind of been key to my career of making the links about dangerous people, that Duffy had raped his wife at knife point up at Hampstead Heath, and a very switched-on police sergeant thought that because DNA was just being used, that he should DNA John Duffy to see if he's going to rape his wife. And if that's what he does to someone who's meant to love, trust, and care about the most, could he not be capable of committing violence and rape and murder to women outside the home? And the DNA matched with those crime scenes. So there have been a number of cases across my career where profiling has played an absolutely pivotal role, certainly in linking serial rapes as well. And of course, if you link the right cases, and I've worked on many of those cases, Richard Baker, who was a DJ rapist, in the late 90s, raping across multiple jurisdictions, and people think that perpetrators stay within police boundaries, but they do not. So we have to think about that when we're linking things, and of course, if you link the right crimes, that can take you to the perpetrator. So it plays a very key role, as we all know. You know, it's another tool. The same as facial profiling, these are all tools of the trade. I was fortunate enough to work at the FBI, which is where I met Jim Fitzgerald, and certainly I met Jim C back at New Scotland Yard. And, you know, when you pull your knowledge in cases, and, you know, we try and get things written up in the literature, but the other key challenge for us is we don't want to educate the criminals as well. So you sort of balance things that you put out there, because all the while when we talk about it in open platforms and forums, guess who are researching? People like Israel Keyes. Even Corey Stainer, he was found with a serial killer book. You know, when Israel Keyes was interviewed, and Jim, the three of us worked on a show called Killer Profile, he was asked an interview, who is it that you admire the most? You know what his answer was? I know these two guys know.
Yes.
He said, I admire the serial killers who are still out there who haven't been caught yet.
And Israel Keyes probably was one of the most brilliant serial killers in the history of the United States, but... when he had a successful double kill.
Brilliant in inverted commas there.
Yes, absolutely. But when he had a very successful kill, nobody even knew that these victims were killed, that were murdered. It just went to his head, and he was so hyped up about it that he decided to, instead of traveling across the country, flying about 1,000 miles, driving another 1,000 miles, going to where he had buried a kill kit years before, and going and finding somebody and just killing them randomly, and then flying back to Alaska. Instead of doing that, he went and hunted in his own backyard, and that was his ultimate demise. We have linked 11 kills to him, but we have 36 trips that he took like that. We have no idea who he killed during those trips. And he killed himself before he would admit to any more than the 11.
Taking the ultimate control. That's him. It's the power and control game. Again, you can see the links across, you know, these are power and control crimes. Even when being interviewed by law enforcement, for the psychopaths, it's all a game. So you have to be attuned to that when you're going into interview, or when you're advising on those interviews. You have to be attuned to that.
If you want to hear more about... Samantha Koenig, who was Israel Keyes, I think his last victim, Bobby Chacon and I did a podcast. You can look it up, and Bobby talks about Samantha.
On Real Crime Profile.
On I'll do one more question, and then maybe I'll hop out real quick and ask a couple. So for all of you, do you ever regret your choice of going into profiling now that you can't unsee the things that you've seen? And do you ever wish that you could go back and choose another career path with less permanent, horrible memories?
Laura, you want to start?
Wow, I wasn't expecting that question. You know, one of the things I reflected on yesterday was, you know, when people are talking about areas in, you know, whether it's the UK or whether it's here, and, you know, they're saying, oh, have you ever been to, and they mention a state or a county, let's say in the UK, Chislehurst, and I'll go to say, oh, yeah, I went to a crime scene there. You know, at a dinner party, everyone's having great fun, you know, and there you are with your mapped out crime in your head, and, you know, that can be a challenge. But I certainly don't regret my career choices. I feel very passionately and very strongly about the work that I've done. Actually, it wasn't a mapped out career. I've really just followed the things that interest me, in the sense that giving victims a voice feels, you know, that part and the injustice. You know, for me, I remember watching The Accused with Jodie Foster, and that had a very profound impact on me. Mm. I can see some of you nodding. I felt very angry watching that. And certainly when the miniseries of Stephen, I know my first name was Stephen, that was another key thing where I thought, this is, you know, I can see my, what I want to do, my aspirations. And I've met some fantastic people. I've seen the worst in life, but I've also seen the best in life. You know, I've seen families who are bereaved, whose loved ones have been killed, who are committed to make sure another family doesn't go through that. And they're the ones, actually, who I admire the most, because you deal with the cards that you get dealt. And many of them, I've gone on to change the laws, you know, in the UK on domestic violence and stalking, and they show huge humility. And we have to have champions and people at the front. And I'm very honoured to do the job that I do and, you know, really join the dots and the cases. There's darkness, but there's also a lot of light. And, you know, I always go into things looking for the best in people and things. And you have to take your time out and enjoy the sunshine and fill up your joy or your life with joy too, which is why some of you will see on social media me running up Upper Yosemite Falls and all sorts of, you know, things that I really enjoy doing. So everything is tempered, I think. Mm. But I think it's, you know, incredibly worthwhile what I do. And I've met some incredible professionals who I work with. The unsung heroes in many respects. So it's a very long answer.
Yeah. Take them.
So I always thought that being an FBI profiler was an amazing way to use your brain to try to stop some brilliant killers and some prolific killers who aren't that brilliant but who know how to play the system. So I believe that it's a rewarding career just based on that, but the people that I've worked with and the families of the victims and the victims themselves are the ones that I did this for. And just being able to save the life of 1 6-year-old boy early in my profiling career, that made up for any of the negative that I experienced over the 22 years that I was in the FBI. So no regrets.
I mean, life-saving, you know, is the other side to it, isn't it? And I probably should have mentioned the DASH, the risk model that I created, that's out of all of the darkness to try and find a way to look at the patterns. You know, and Tim Ferriss, for example, does a brilliant podcast. Give a shout out to him. He looks for patterns in success. Well, we've looked at patterns, you know, in darkness. But for me, it's about public protection and using those lessons and those patterns to keep people alive. They're the cases I'd rather be working on, and I've dedicated most of my career to that, of actually keeping people safe. So sometimes we don't know people that we've touched in the work that we do, but a lot of times I do get emails from victims and families, certainly through Real Crime Profile, and brothers and fathers and sisters and mothers saying thank you for doing the work that you do. Well, I don't make that a public profile, but that for me, you know, is hugely rewarding when they contact me to say you saved my daughter's life or my sister's life, and that's hugely rewarding. How about you, Fitz?
Yeah, my career, like a few other profilers of which I am aware, interesting trajectory in that as a young police officer, 22 years of age, I was right there on the scene, right after a shooting or a stabbing, a drowning, accidental, on purpose, whatever the scenario. And I did save a few lives then, helped a few mothers give birth to, and those little babies are who knows how old now. But and then as I moved on as a detective sergeant, then quit the police department, joined the FBI. Now I'm back working bank robberies in New York, and Jim was there with me in those days, and there would be some teller shot, some armored car drivers and guards shot, and we'd be right there, and the bodies would still be warm. We're applying first aid. Then I became a profiler, and in a way, I almost felt like I was taking the easy way out because I was only looking at pictures mostly. Quite frankly, I love Criminal Minds. I work for the show, too, but real profilers don't always get on crime scenes within an hour or two of them happening.
Yeah, mostly we only do that for child abductions because of that critical time nature.
And all of a sudden, I just found myself looking at pictures and reading reports. And then, as many of you know, I sort of morphed into forensic linguistics. So then I kind of went to just reading documents about violent crimes. So I went from very early on seeing, you know, bloody crime scenes and hopefully helping people either at the scene itself or maybe through the investigation to mostly looking at pictures and words afterwards. So in my life, I think I'd rather have it that way than flip the other way and still going out and looking at some of those crime scenes now. And I give lots of credit to the men and women in law enforcement, CSI, maybe some of you in here who still do this job because it's not easy. I spent the last few years writing about these things, and quite frankly, I had some nightmares that I hadn't had in a while. So it was very difficult at times. But to answer the ultimate question, I have no regrets, and I'm glad now to take that information and impart it to folks like you in the room, certainly listening in the podcast, and when we go out and train law enforcement folks around the country and around the world. So no regrets.
Well, I know I'm very grateful for all of you, and I consider it an honor to do this podcast with you, and you're my heroes. I know I say it all the time.
And you're but our it's hero really too, Lisa.
We love you, Lisa.
So I know
she hires people on Criminal Minds that make us look good, right?
That's right. So I think we're at the end of our time. Nobody's kicking us out yet, so should I ask a couple questions from the audience? I'll grab this, and if you want to say
any burning questions.
Huh? Is this on? Okay, does anybody have any questions? Okay.
I'm going to get a workout.
Sorry, here, Lisa. Hi, what's your name?
Anne.
Anne, what's your question?
Maybe this is a topic for a whole new episode, but I'm just wondering, how do you empower children to recognize stranger danger and what they can do about it?
Well, the thing
That's
is
a great question.
That empowering them to recognize stranger danger is simple. Strangers are people they don't know. The problem is empowering children to know that the real threat is from people they know, trust, and love. People their parents trust. People that we turn these children over to because we trust the people. And those people are harboring a sexual attraction to children, and that is the greatest danger to children. So if we can have an open dialogue with children from the very beginning, while they're in the womb, why not start then?
I remember
you haven't had children, have you, Blissom?
And don't stop. No, you don't have to. You can be loving and supportive and so forth, but don't stop until they're grown people. That's
and just
all.
To add to that, it's something I heard Jim say some time ago on the Katie Connick show, because it kind of sums it up. If somebody outside your family wants to spend more time with your children than you do, you should be asking questions about them, right? I can see you all nodding, just on a very basic baseline behavior.
Okay. Your name?
Kathy, on the original profile in the 1940s of Albert Fish, how did the man who profiled him, how was he accepted by the people when he told them, you're going to find him, he's going to be living with his mother or alone or in a double-breasted button-down suit?
Well, he was wholly rejected at first. But when they did find him living with his mother in a three-piece button-down suit, they came around. So actually, it took them a long time to stop this guy. He was the most prolific bomber, I think, in U.S. history. And so they eventually realized they weren't getting anything with traditional methods, went back to him, and they started listening to him. And it did, in fact, solve the case, if you're listening out there.
See? Okay.
Hi, my name's Jennifer. Huge fan of the show. And
Thank
I figured...
You.
Since this is the only opportunity I'm ever going to get to ask this question of real profilers, what do you think happened to the Zodiac Killer?
Wow.
Your professional opinion.
Jim?
None of us worked the case. We aren't quite that old, even though it's still considered an open case, and we've seen the movies, read the books. My strongest connection to that case is a dotted line connection was when I was working the Unabom case. There were a lot of people back in the day that were convinced the Zodiac killer, who since went silent, because he was, late 60s through the mid 70s or so, and all of a sudden the Unabomber shows up in 1978 with his first bomb. They thought he was one and the same person. And I had done enough research on serial killers, serial bombers at that time, and it's a very different set of crimes or a modus operandi to go up and stab somebody multiple times, put them in bindings and tie them up, whatever, than to explode and, you know, design a bomb and mail it long distance. Two completely different types of crimes. I'm not saying it would never happen, but we just felt that was unusual. So as far as the Zodiac killer himself, it is an unsolved case. He left written communications. Despite what the movie had to say, I was told at least some of his code was never actually broken. I have a feeling he probably couldn't control himself and truly stop, so he may have actually died off or gone to prison for what other reason.
Okay, maybe one more question.
Well, hi, I'm Erin. I had a question for you about the public, not just having a sex offender registry, but making it public. What is your opinion on that? And do you have statistics or anecdotes about how it has helped solve other abductions or other sexual, or has it just sort of created problems for people?
Well, I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it has just sort of created problems, but I will say that it is the first place that people look when a child goes missing. And I don't know many cases that were actually resolved that way. That said, one of the cases that I did in Churchill Downs, outside of a racetrack there, a four-year-old boy went missing. The last person who had seen and reported that child last seen was actually a registered sex offender. And thanks to a study done in the UK, we found that 85% of the cases in which the last known sighting was by a registered sex offender, that person abducted and killed the kid. So in that case, I turned everybody around from where they were looking, which was literally across the United States of America, to go back to that neighborhood, go back to the place that's right across the street from where he was last seen, go back to the person who did that, who made the report. Check the garbage dump behind his house, the trash cans behind his house. The sheriff refused to do it. I ordered an FBI agent to do it. He goes out. When he's approaching the garbage cans, the manager of the building tells him they've already been searched. He turns around and goes home. On Monday, when the garbage truck came and they went to empty the garbage trucks, they found the boy. So it does help us in certain cases, maybe a very limited number of cases, but if it helps us in one, I think it's worth it.
Okay, so this is the real last question.
Okay. My name is Sarah, and I just wanted to ask, as people that have been part of the BAU and profilers, what is maybe the most common background of people that come into the BAU, and also maybe one piece of advice of something to get involved in if anybody was interested in pursuing a career like this?
I think lunatics would be... No, I'm sorry.
He looks at me, you notice.
Yes, of course. I would say that when Jim and I wanted to become profilers, there were no forensic psychology programs. There were no master's programs in forensic psychology. There are plenty today. And in fact, Jim and I both have guest lectured in those kinds of programs. I would say that that's probably the best way to do it, because profiling doesn't necessarily have to be in the FBI or in a law enforcement agency, but it can be useful in your life. I mean, it does help you being able to read other people's behavior, being able to tell when somebody is lying to you or telling you the truth, being able to understand why your gut is telling you don't go in this situation, don't trust that person, and then listening to it. That's something that can help anybody. But I think the closest training outside of the BAU is probably a master's course in forensic psychology.
And I would add to that, I agree 100% with what Jim just said, but somehow find yourself in a profession, a caseworker of some sort, perhaps dealing with people in halfway houses, prisoners get to know sort of the criminal mind in a complete safe way. You don't want to go to the bar that says, you know, criminals only on the door. But I mean, somewhere, if you have an interest in that, where you do have some sort of interaction, because there's a whole psychopathy behind these people. They think and act different than any of us do in this room. And I think knowing how they function, maybe even working in a prison, they need, you know, counselors in there, whatever, volunteer. And again, safety is always number one here. But if you can do that, I think knowing the criminal mind is what really helps you. That's why they send us into prison as young profilers to interview these guys. I mean, I've interviewed plenty of people as a police officer, interrogated them, whatever, and Jim and I did in, you know, New York City too. But some of the profilers don't have that much necessarily experience in that regard. So sitting down with the convicted criminals, they're not going anywhere. There's no deal offered. They're not getting the window view of the bay. They're in there for life. You'd be surprised, though, how they want to sit and tell you about the crimes they committed. It's all they have left.
And just to add to that, I mean, working in charities as well, victims' charities, when you work with victims of crime, you hear an awful lot about the perpetrator side to it. So there's different entry points, you know, the same in the UK. It's that exposure. I would definitely echo, you know, just to sum up, trust your instinct. No matter who you are, where you are, and what you do, that's one of our golden rules with stalking victims. But also when I work with law enforcement and train them, I always say to professionals, always trust your instinct. Something doesn't feel right, and we always recommend Gavin De Becker's The Gift of Fear, the book. And just to say, you're all facial profilers, right? You might not think that you're a facial profiler, but you all gauge your loved ones, people around you, whether they're happy, sad, upset, something good that's happened. You know, there's a huge amount of, you may have seen the show Lie to Me with Tim Roth, but we're all amateur facial profilers. I've actually done the courses as well on facial profiling, even though I thought there was nothing in it 10 years ago. And then I worked with families bereaved and I realized there were some commonalities. You know, there's a lot to be said for that, the micro expressions and the things that we see. So you're all facial profilers at the very least.
So speaking of criminal minds, there are two shows that I want to encourage you to watch this season. And season 13 of Criminal Minds is coming up, and we hope you'll tune in and see Jim's wonderful writing and my not so bad casting. But there's another show that is coming, and tell us about it.
I think I know which one to which you refer. Yes, I'm very happy. Manhunt, the Unabomber, premieres August 1st. It's an 8-part miniseries on the Discovery Channel. Jim and I pitched this years ago with our friend Tony Gittleson, and finally was picked up by Kevin Spacey's production company. Discovery Channel bought it. Sam Worthington, the actor, is playing me. Paul Bettany is playing the Unabomber.
He's very happy about that.
Yeah, he's
FYI.
Not.
Sidebar.
It's like, you know, Matt Damon turned it down, but he's pretty happy with
and Sam's
Sam Worthington.
A Brit, so I'm happy about
Look
that.
Look up in the dictionary the definition of the word surreal, then sit in a soundstage and watch someone acting as you with your name, saying words you said in a realistic situation from 20 years ago. It is surreal. Watch the show.
Said
I think you'll like it.
Said the forensic linguist.
And so I want to thank everyone in the audience, and I want to thank all our listeners. Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the Domestic Violence Hotline on 800-799-7233.